Hello, and welcome to the Story of Singapore, Episode 1, The Birth of Singapura. Like many ancient civilizations, Singapore's early history is shrouded in mystery. We do not know much about its pre-colonial era, but archaeological evidence suggests that a significant trading settlement did exist on the island nearly 700 years ago. One of the few pieces of writings that detail events in this period is a collection of stories that are part myth and part history, known as the Malay Annals. The original text was written on traditional paper around 600 years ago, but it has since gone through multiple rounds of copies and changes. At least 30 different manuscripts have been identified by scholars that exist today. But going over all the minor differences between these variants would be unnecessarily tedious. So I will just be referring to the English translation by C.C. Brown, based on the Raffles Manuscript 18 variant, which is generally considered the oldest and most faithful to the original source. The tale begins with a certain man from Macedonia, described as the Two-Horn. His name was Raja Iskandar. Raja being an Indianized royal title that is equivalent to a king or prince. He was leading a military expedition to the east, and when he reached the borders of India, he came face to face with a powerful Indian king who held control over half of all India. There, the two armies engaged in battle, but the Indian king was soundly defeated and taken prisoner. When Raja Iskandar ordered him to embrace the Islamic faith, the king accepted, and shortly thereafter was released back to his country. The Indian king had a daughter of unparalleled beauty and wisdom. Upon his return, he discussed with his chief minister in private, and then offered her hand in marriage to Raja Iskandar. The Macedonian accepted the proposal. After the wedding ceremony, Raja Iskandar took the princess with him as he continued his conquest. Sometime later, Raja Iskandar came back from his military campaign in the east. The Indian king went out to greet him, bearing precious gifts and proclamations of his undying devotion. Then he told Raja Iskandar how much he had missed his daughter and that he wished for her to be restored to his side. In an act of grace, Raja Iskandar gave the princess back to her father before taking his departure back to Macedonia. Now, the identity of this Raja Iskandar has been a subject of debate, but the majority of modern scholars believe him to be Alexander the Great, or at least an interpretation of him that can also be found in Islamic legend as Dhul-Qanin, a name which translates as He of the Two Horns. Of course, the rabbit hole goes deeper when we further investigate both characters, because the real Alexander died when he was 32 years old, while Dhul-Qanin was said to have lived for a few hundred years. Whatever the case may be, the princess was expecting. But neither Raja Iskandar nor the princess herself was aware of it. It was not until a month after he had left, when she realized that she had not menstruated for 2 months, that the pregnancy was discovered. Upon learning this, the Indian king was over the moon and lavished his daughter with great care. In due course, the princess gave birth to a grandson, who would succeed the throne when the king eventually passed, and go on to sire a long line of Indian kings. Several centuries later, a key descendant by the name of Raja Chulan would ascend the throne when his father died. The kingdom that Raja Chulan inherited was vast, and all the states from east to west were his vassals, except for one who refused to acknowledge his suzerainty, China. In response, Raja Chulan mustered his troops and set forth to conquer the realm of China. It is said that his army was so huge in size that it brought the very lands it passed through to ruin. Forests were turned into plains, the ground shook like earthquake. Mountains moved, and their summits came crashing down, even the highest of hills were leveled, and the mightiest of rivers ran dry. 6 months passed, but the tail of the marching column had yet to be sighted. The gleam on their weapons was so bright that dark nights were turned into full moons, and the roar of thunders could not be heard over the noise of the advancing host. After a time, they arrived at a particular place called Temasek. This was the very name Singapore had before its renaming. Meanwhile, China just received news of the impending invasion. Faced with impossible odds on the battlefield, the anxious Chinese emperor summoned his ministers and officers to deliberate on a course of action to avert the crisis. The chief minister had a bright idea. First, he arranged for a ship to be made ready and had it filled with needles that were rusty and worn down. Next, he collected trees that had fruited and had them planted on board the ship. Then, he chose several men so old that their teeth had all fallen out and put them on board. Finally, he ordered the ship to sail to Temasek, and the plan was set in motion. Back in Temasek, when word of an arriving Chinese ship reached Raja Chulan's camp, he ordered his men to interrogate the sailors to find out how far China was from Temasek. The Chinese replied that they had left China when they barely turned 12. The fruit trees on the ship were planted by them from sea, and only now had they just made the journey. As the pièce de résistance, they presented several of the needles and claimed that these pieces of steel were once as thick as a man's forearm, but had since worn down to nothing. When the men related this story to Raja Chulan, his ambitions for a mighty conquest faltered. He decided it was too far away and that it was time for them to head home. His war chiefs concurred. Raja Chulan spent some time in reflection. He had travelled across the lands and came to know all that lived on it. But what about the sea? And what about all that dwelt in it? With that, he declared his intention to embark on a different venture. He commanded his craftsmen and artisans to build him a glass case that would lower him into the sea. Satisfied with the workmanship, he climbed into the vessel and submerged into the waters. As Raja Chulan descended, he was awestruck by the beauty of the marine world. When he reached the bottom, he came upon an underwater city and was greeted by a race of aquamen, who were equally astonished by his presence. They took him to their king, who was so fascinated by the idea of an overland world that he took Raja Chulan's presence as a gift from God and seated him on the throne. Then, the king wedded his daughter to him, and from this matrimony came 3 sons. However, after 3 years of marriage, Raja Chulan watched his sons with a heavy heart as he lamented how they were fated to live the rest of their lives below the earth. He appealed to the underwater king for his 3 sons to be sent to earth when they reached manhood, so that the bloodline of Raja Iskandar would continue for all time. To which the king agreed. But when he then sought permission to depart and leave the sea, the king was devastated. Acquiescing to his request, the king summoned a winged stallion and gave it to Raja Chulan, who mounted the steed and returned to his realm. Raja Chulan's story would conclude with his retirement and eventual death. We pan away and bring into view 2 widows on the outskirts of Palembang, a city which exists today in South Sumatra of Indonesia. One night from their farmhouse, the widows spotted a bright glow emanating from the hilltop. Fearing that it was the gleam of a gem from a dragon's head, the ladies went to sleep. When morning dawned, the two, hoping to satiate their curiosity, set out to investigate the source of the light. As they climbed the hill, they were shocked to find their paddy fields changed. Their rice now had grains of literal gold, leaves of silver, and stems of gold alloy. Even the crest of the hill had turned into gold. At the center of it all were three beautiful youths riding white elephants. They were brilliantly adorned like kings and wore crowns studded with gemstones. The widows were mesmerized. The three men then revealed themselves to be the descendants of Raja Iskandar. They were the sons of Raja Chulan, and they had just come of age. Thrilled and rich beyond measure, the women took the young princess back to their house. Meanwhile, word of the miracle spread like wildfire, and it was not long before the king of Palembang had heard about the story. He paid the princess a visit before bringing them back with him into the city. Every ruler from every part of the country flocked to pay their respects. The two older brothers were each taken to a different country and crowned its king. But the youngest of the three, and the most important in this story, remained at Palembang, where the king gave the prince the title of Sang Utama, along with his kingship, before abdicating and becoming the new king's chief minister. I've neglected to mention many names thus far, because I find that including too many names of the many side characters just bogs the flow of the story down. But here, there is an important annotation to make. Depending on the version of the Malay annals that you have read, or what you have heard, especially if you're a Singaporean, you may come across a character instead named Sang Nila Utama, with a different origin story to our Sang Utamas. Well, just so you know, Sang Utama's birth name is Nila Tanam, which makes him a Sang Nila Utama too. Confusing, I know, but just remember that even though their origin stories conflict with each other, Sang Utama and Sang Nila Utama are generally the same character. In the meantime, we check in with our two widows from earlier, or more accurately, their cow, because suddenly it began spewing foam from its mouth. And from this foam, by the will of God, came forth a human being. The man had one job. He stood up and recited a divine decree, conferring upon Sang Utama an even fancier title, Sri Tribhuwana, which translates to Lord of Three Worlds, the three worlds possibly referring to the realms of gods, men, and demons. When Sang Utama, or should I say Sri Tribhuwana, was fully established on the throne, he began looking for a consort. Whenever he found a beautiful daughter of a prince, he would take her to be his wife. However, each time the king consummated his marriage, the bride would be stricken with a horrible skin disorder in the following morning, and upon which the king would abandon her. No fewer than 39 wives were deserted because of this mysterious affliction. It then came to Sri Tribhuwana's knowledge that his chief minister too had a daughter, whose beauty was described as having no equal at the time. So the king approached him to ask for his daughter's hand in marriage. Knowing that his daughter would certainly suffer the same ailment, he told the king he would accept the marriage proposal if the king promised that he and his descendants would be fair and just in their rule. Sri Tribhuwana agreed to the terms and then offered his side of the deal as well, that the chief minister and his descendants would remain undividedly loyal to him and his lineage. With that, the two of them entered into a sacred covenant, one which would form the basis of the relationship between future Malay rulers and their subjects. For now, Sri Tribhuwana was wedded to his 40th princess. When night had fallen, the king slept with his new bride, but when morning came, she was found to be completely unaffected. The king and her father were elated that the curse had finally broken. The chief minister then arranged for the king's ceremonial ablution. For the next 40 days and 40 nights, festivities were organized to celebrate the royal union before finally the king and his consort took their seats in the palace. After living in Palembang for a while, Sri Tribhuvana decided that it was high time for him to settle a new city. His chief minister obliged, calling his men to prepare the fleet while appointing his younger brother as regent in the king's absence. Then, the king, his consort, the chief minister, and their retinue of court officials and war chiefs set sail. News of the voyage reached the ruler of Bintan, an island that is a part of Indonesia's Riau archipelago. Its ruler, a queen, had hoped to marry the prestigious king of Palembang, so she sent two envoys to meet with Sri Tribhuvana and invite him to the palace. However, upon his arrival, the Bintan queen was stunned to discover just how young the king was. So, she decided to adopt him instead and name him her successor to Bintan. After staying in the palace for a while, Sri Tribhuvana grew bored. He sought to leave the compounds and distract himself by hunting for sport. The queen remonstrated with him, but when he proved to be so stubborn that he would rather die than suffer from boredom any longer, she relented. And so he went, accompanied by his royal entourage. While his consort and her handmaidens played and amused themselves on the beach, the king and his men were on the hunt. Now, this is the part of the story that Singaporeans would be most familiar with. While searching for big game, Sri Tribhuvana spotted a deer and stabbed it, but the injured animal managed to escape. The men gave chase up the hill before Sri Tribhuvana caught up and delivered the final blow. There, he came across a large rock, and when he climbed to the top, he saw, across the water, a stretch of beach so white that it looked like a sheet of cloth. When he inquired about the island, the queen's envoy told him that it was the island of Temasek. They boarded a ship and sailed for Temasek. However, when they crossed into the open water, a violent storm whipped up and the vessel began to leak, filling up with seawater. The shipmaster ordered his men to lighten the ship, and they dumped baggage after baggage into the sea. But they were unable to bail the boat dry. The water continued to rise. Everything that could be thrown overboard was thrown, except for the king's crown. The shipmaster advised Sri Tribhuvana to cast away his crown, and he complied. At once, the storm died down, and the men safely made it to the shores of Temasek. Then the king did what any sporting royal would do, continue his hunt. But out of the blue, they saw a strange animal. It had a red body, a black head, and a white breast. It moved with great speed and was muscular in build. Just as swift as it had appeared, it vanished into the forest. When Sri Tribhuvana asked about the beast, no one could give an answer. His chief minister speculated that it was a lion of an ancient time. With that as a sign of good omen, Sri Tribhuvana sent the queen's envoy back to announce that he would not be returning to Bintan, and that if his adoptive mother wished to show her affection for him, she would supply him with men, elephants, and horses so he can build a city in Temasek. Needless to say, the Bintan queen acceded to his request. And so, Sri Tribhuvana, better known as Sang Nila Utama, supposed descendant of Alexander the Great, established a city on Temasek and gave it the name of Singapura, meaning Lion City in Sanskrit. It should be pointed out, however, that lions have never actually lived in Singapore, and the closest known distribution of wild lions occurs in Western India. Therefore, the identity of the beast has been postulated to be a tiger instead, which means Tiger City might have been the more apt name. Then again, Viagra Por just doesn't have the same ring to it, does it? Next episode, we will wrap up Sri Tribhuvana's reign in the Kingdom of Singapura and follow the stories of his descendants who will form a line of succession known as the Five Kings of Singapura.